question requiring the services of one or more. On our route, we passed the Grand Coteau, or prairie, a vast space of level, monotonous country, without a tree, except an occasional one which had been transplanted near some dilapidated dwelling. It was once thickly populated and under cultivation, but for some cause had been abandoned. The business of the scattered inhabitants that now dwell upon it is principally raising cattle. Immense herds were feeding upon it as we passed. In the center of the Grand Coteau, one feels as if he were on the ocean, out of sight of land. As far as the eye can see in all directions, is but a ruined and deserted waste. I was hired to Judge Turner, a distinguished man, an extensive planter, whose large estate is situated on Bayou Salle, within a few miles of the Gulf. Bayou Salle is a small stream flowing into the Bay of Chafalaya. For some days, I was employed at Turner's in repairing his sugar house when a cane knife was put into my hand, and with 30 or 40 others, I was sent into the field. I found no such difficulty in learning the art of cutting cane that I had in picking cotton. It came to me naturally and intuitively, and in a short time I was able to keep up with the fastest knife. Before the cutting was over, however, Judge Turner transferred me from the field to the sugar house, to act there in the capacity of driver. From the time of the commencement of sugar-making to the close, the grinding and boiling does not cease day or night. The whip was given me with directions to use it upon anyone who was caught standing idle. If I failed to obey them to the letter, there was another one for my own back. In addition to this, my duty was to call on and off the different gangs at the proper time. I had no regular periods of rest and could never snatch but a few moments of sleep at a time. It is the custom in Louisiana, as I presume it is in other slave states, to allow the slave to retain whatever compensation he may obtain for services performed on Sundays. In this way only are they able to provide themselves with any luxury or convenience whatever. When a slave, purchased or kidnapped in the North, is transported to a cabin on Bayou Bœuf, he is furnished with neither knife, nor fork, nor dish, nor kettle, nor any other thing in the shape of crockery or furniture of any nature or description. He is furnished with a blanket before he reaches there, and wrapping that around him, he can either stand up or lie down upon the ground or on a board, if his master has no use for it. He is at liberty to find a gourd in which to keep his meal, or he can eat his corn from the cob, just as he pleases. To ask the master for a knife or skillet or any small convenience of the kind will be answered with a kick or laughed at as a joke. Whatever necessary article of this nature is found in the cabin has been purchased with Sunday money. However injurious to the morals, it is certainly a blessing to the physical condition of the slave to be permitted to break the Sabbath. Otherwise, there would be no way to provide himself with any utensils which seem to be indispensable to him who is compelled to be his own cook. On cane plantations in sugar time, there is no distinction as to the days of the week. It is well understood that all hands must labor on the Sabbath, and is equally well understood that those especially who are hired, as I was to Judge Turner and others in succeeding years, shall receive remuneration for it. It is usual also, in the most hurrying time of cotton picking, to require the same extra service. From this source, slaves generally are afforded an opportunity of earning sufficient to purchase a knife, a kettle, tobacco, and so forth. The females, discarding the latter luxury, are apt to expend their little revenue in the purchase of gaudy ribbons, wherewithal to deck their hair in the merry season of the holidays. I remained in St. Mary's until the 1st of January, during which time my Sunday money amounted to $10. I met with other good fortune, for which I was indebted to my violin, my constant companion, the source of profit and soother of my sorrows during years of servitude. There was a grand party of whites assembled at Mr. Yarney's in Centerville, a hamlet in the vicinity of Turner's Plantation. I was employed to play for them, and so well pleased were the merrymakers with my performance that a contribution was taken for my benefit, which amounted to $17. With this sum in possession, I was looked upon by my fellows as a millionaire. It afforded me great pleasure to look at it, to count it over and over again, day after day, Visions of cabin furniture, of water pails, of pocket knives, new shoes and coats and hats, floated through my fancy, and up through all rose the triumphant contemplation that I was the wealthiest nigger on Bayou Bef. Vessels run up the Rio Teche to Centerville. While there, I was bold enough one day to present myself before the captain of the steamer and beg permission to hide myself among the freight. I was emboldened to risk the hazard of such a step from overhearing a conversation in the course of which I ascertained he was a native of the North. I did not relate to him the particulars of my history, but only expressed an ardent desire to escape from slavery to a free state. He pitied me, but said it would be impossible to avoid the vigilant custom house officers in New Orleans, and that detection would subject him to punishment and his vessel to confiscation. My earnest entreaties evidently excited his sympathies, and doubtless he would have yielded to them could he have done so with any kind of safety. I was compelled to smother the sudden flame that lighted up my bosom with sweet hope of liberation, and turn my steps once more toward the increasing darkness of despair. Immediately after this event, the drove assembled at Centerville, and several of the owners having arrived and collected the monies due for our services, we were driven back to Bayou Bef. It was on our return, while passing through a small village, that I caught sight of Tibbetts, seated in the door of a dirty grocery, looking somewhat seedy and out of repair. Passion and poor whiskey, I doubt not, have ere this laid him on the shelf. During our absence, I learned from Aunt Phoebe and Patsy that the latter had been getting deeper and deeper into trouble. The poor girl was truly an object of pity. Old Hogjaw, the name by which Epps was called when the slaves were by themselves, had beaten her more severely and frequently than ever. As surely as he came from Holmesville, elated with liquor, and it was often in those days he would whip her, merely to gratify the mistress, would punish her to an extent almost beyond endurance, for an offense of which he himself was the sole and irresistible cause. In his sober moments, he could not always be prevailed upon to indulge his wife's insatiable thirst for vengeance. To be rid of Patsy, to place her beyond sight or reach, by sale or death or in any other manner, of late years, seemed to be the ruling thought and passion of my mistress. Patsy had been a favorite when a child, even in the great house. She had been petted and admired for her uncommon sprightliness and pleasant disposition. She had been fed many a time, so Uncle Abram said, even on biscuit and milk, when the madam in her younger days was wont to call her to the piazza and fondle her as she would a playful kitten. But a sad change had come over the spirit of the woman. Now only black and angry fiends ministered in the temple of her heart, until she could look on Patsy but with concentrated venom. Mistress Epps was not naturally such an evil woman. After all, she was possessed of the devil, jealousy, it is true, but aside from that, there was much in her character to admire. Her father, Mr. Roberts, resided in Cheneyville, an influential and honorable man, and as much respected throughout the parish as any other citizen. She had been well educated at some institution this side the Mississippi, was beautiful, accomplished, and usually good-humored. She was kind to all of us but Patsy, frequently, in the absence of her husband, sending out to us some little dainty from her own table. In other situations, in a different society from that which exists on the shore of Bayou Bef, she would have been pronounced an elegant and fascinating woman. An ill wind it was that blew her into the arms of Epps. He respected and loved his wife as much as a coarse nature like his is capable of loving. But supreme selfishness always overmastered conjugal affection. He loved as well as baser natures can, but a mean heart and soul were in that man. He was ready to gratify any whim, to grant any request she made, provided it did not cost too much. Patsy was equal to any two of his slaves in the cotton field. He could not replace her with the same money she would bring. The idea of disposing of her, therefore, could not be entertained. The mistress did not regard her at all in that light. The pride of the haughty woman was aroused. The blood of the fiery Southern boiled at the sight of Patsy, and nothing less than trampling out the life of the helpless bondwoman would satisfy her. Sometimes the current of her wrath turned upon him whom she had just caused to hate. But the storm of angry words would pass over at length, and there would be a season of calm again. At such times, Patsy trembled with fear, and cried as if her heart would break, for she knew from painful experience that if Mistress should work herself to the red-hot pitch of rage, Epps would quiet her at last with a promise that Patsy should be flogged. A promise he was sure to keep. Thus did pride, jealousy, and vengeance war with avarice and brute passion in the mansion of my master, filling it with daily tumult and contention. Thus upon the head of Patsy, the simple-minded slave, in whose heart God had implanted the seeds of virtue, the force of all these domestic tempests spent itself at last. During the summer succeeding my return from St. Mary's Parish, I conceived a plan of providing myself with food, which, though simple, succeeded beyond expectation. It has been followed by many others in my condition, up and down the bayou, and of such benefit has it become that I am almost persuaded to look upon myself as a benefactor. That summer, the worms got into the bacon. Nothing but ravenous hunger could induce us to swallow it. The weekly allowance of meal scarcely sufficed to satisfy us. It was customary with us, as it is with all in that region, where the allowance is exhausted before Saturday night, or is in such a state as to render it nauseous and disgusting, to hunt in the swamps for coon and possum. This, however, must be done at night, after the day's work is accomplished. There are planters whose slaves, for months at a time, have no other meat than such as is obtained in this manner. No objections are made to hunting, inasmuch as it dispenses with drafts upon the smokehouse, because every marauding coon that is killed is so much saved from the standing corn. They are hunted with dogs and clubs, slaves not being allowed the use of firearms. The flesh of the coon is palatable, but verily there is nothing in all butcherdom so delicious as a roasted possum. They are a round, rather long-bodied little animal of a whitish color, with nose like a pig and caudal extremity like a rat. They burrow among the roots and in the hollows of the gum tree and are clumsy and slow of motion. They are deceitful and cunning creatures. On receiving the slightest tap of a stick, they will roll over on the ground and feign death. If the hunter leaves them in pursuit of another, without first taking particular pains to break his neck, the chances are, on his return, he is not to be found. The little animal has outwitted the enemy, has played possum, and is off. But after a long and hard day's work, the weary slave feels little like going to the swamp for his supper, and after time prefers throwing himself on the cabin floor without it. It is for the interest of the master that the servant should not suffer in health from starvation, and it is also for his interest that he should not become gross from overfeeding. In the estimation of the owner, a slave is most serviceable when in rather a lean and lank condition, such a condition as the racehorse is in, when fitted for the course, and in that condition they are generally to be found on the sugar and cotton plantations along Red River. My cabin was within a few rods of the bayou bank, and necessity being indeed the mother of invention, I resolved upon a mode of obtaining the requisite amount of food, without the trouble of resorting nightly to the woods. This was to construct a fish trap, having in my mind conceived the manner in which it could be done. The next Sunday I set about putting it into practical execution. It may be impossible for me to convey to the reader a full and correct idea of its construction, but the following will serve as a general description. A frame between 2 and 3 feet square is made, and of a greater or less height according to the depth of water. Boards or slats are nailed on 3 sides of this frame, not so closely, however, as to prevent the water circulating freely through it. A door is fitted into the 4th side, in such a manner that it will slide easily up and down in the grooves cut in the 2 posts. A movable bottom is then so fitted that it can be raised to the top of the frame without difficulty. In the center of the movable bottom, an auger hole is bored, and into this one end of a handle or round stick is fastened on the underside so loosely that it will turn. The handle ascends from the center of the movable bottom to the top of the frame, or as much higher as is desirable. Up and down this handle, in a great many places, are gimlet holes, through which small sticks are inserted, extending to opposite sides of the frame. So many of these small sticks are running out from the handle in all directions that a fish of any considerable dimensions cannot pass through without hitting one of them. The frame is then placed in the water and made stationary. The trap is set by sliding or drawing up the door and kept in that position by another stick, one end of which rests in a notch on the inner side, the other end in a notch made in the handle running up from the center of the movable bottom. The trap is baited by rolling a handful of wet meal and cotton together until it becomes hard, and depositing it in the back part of the frame. A fish swimming through the upraised door towards the bait necessarily strikes one of the small sticks, turning the handle, which, displacing the stick supporting the door, the latter falls, securing the fish within the frame. Taking hold of the top of the handle, the movable bottom is then drawn up to the surface of the water, and the fish taken out. There may have been other such traps in use before mine was constructed, but if there were, I had never happened to see one. Bayou Bœuf abounds in fish of large size and excellent quality, and after this time I was very rarely in want of one for myself or for my comrades. Thus a mine was opened. A new resource was developed, hitherto unthought of by the enslaved children of Africa, who toil in hunger along the shores of that sluggish but prolific stream. About the time of which I am now writing, an event occurred in our immediate neighborhood, which made a deep impression upon me, and which shows the state of society existing there, and the manner in which affronts are oftentimes avenged. Directly opposite our quarters, on the other side of the bayou, was situated the plantation of Mr. Marshall. He belonged to a family among the most wealthy and aristocratic in the country. A gentleman from the vicinity of Natchez had been negotiating with him for the purchase of the estate. One day a messenger came in great haste to our plantation, saying that a bloody and fearful battle was going on at Marshall's, that blood had been spilled, and unless the combatants were forthwith separated, the result would be disastrous. On repairing to Marshall's house, a scene presented itself that beggars description. On the floor of one of the rooms lay the ghastly corpse of the man from Natchez, while Marshall, enraged and covered with wounds and blood, was stalking back and forth, breathing out threatenings and slaughter. A difficulty had arisen in the course of the negotiation. High words ensued. When drawing their weapons, the deadly strife began that ended so unfortunately. Marshall was never placed in confinement. A sort of trial or investigation was had at Marksville. When he was acquitted and returned to his plantation, rather more respected, as I thought, than ever, from the fact that the blood of a fellow being was on his soul. Epps interested himself in his behalf, accompanying him to Marksville, and on all occasions loudly justifying him. But his services in the respect did not afterwards deter a kinsman of this same Marshall from seeking his life also. A brawl occurred between them over a gambling table, which terminated in a deadly feud. Riding up on horseback in front of the house one day, armed with pistols and bowie knife, Marshall challenged him to come forth and make a final settlement of the quarrel, or he would brand him as a coward and shoot him like a dog the first opportunity. Not through cowardice, nor from any conscientious scruples, in my opinion, but through the influence of his wife, he was restrained from accepting the challenge of his enemy. A reconciliation, however, was effected afterwards, since which time they have been on terms of the closest intimacy. Such occurrences, which would bring upon the parties concerned in them merited and condign punishment in the northern states, are frequent on the bayou, and pass without notice and almost without comment. Every man carries his bowie knife, and when two fall out, they set to work hacking and thrusting at each other, more like savages than civilized and enlightened beings. The existence of slavery, in its most cruel form among them, has a tendency to brutalize the humane and finer feelings of their nature. Daily witnesses of human suffering, listening to the agonizing screeches of the slave, beholding him writhing beneath the merciless lash, bitten and torn by dogs, dying without attention, and buried without shroud or coffin. It cannot otherwise be expected than that they should become brutified and reckless of human life. It is true there are many kind-hearted and good men in the parish of Avoyelles, such men as William Ford, who can look with pity upon the sufferings of a slave, just as there are, over all the world, sensitive and sympathetic spirits who cannot look with indifference upon the sufferings of any creature which the Almighty has endowed with life. It is not the fault of the slaveholder that he is cruel, so much as it is the fault of the system under which he lives. He cannot withstand the influence of habit and associations that surround him. Taught from earliest childhood by all that he sees and hears that the rod is for the slave's back, he will not be apt to change his opinions in maturer years. There may be humane masters, as there certainly are inhuman ones. There may be slaves well clothed, well fed, and happy, as there are surely those half clad, half starved, and miserable. Nevertheless, the institution that tolerates such wrong and inhumanity as I have witnessed is a cruel, unjust, and barbarous one. Men may write fictions portraying lowly life as it is or as it is not, may expatiate with owlless gravity upon the bliss of ignorance, discourse flippantly from armchairs of the pleasures of slave life, but let them toil with him in the field, sleep with him in the cabin, feed with him on husks, let them behold him scourged, hunted, trampled on, and they will come back with another story in their mouths. Let them know the heart of the poor slave. Learn his secret thoughts, thoughts he dare not utter in the hearing of the white man. Let them sit by him in the silent watches of the night, converse with him in trustful confidence of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and they will find that 99 out of every 100 are intelligent enough to understand their situation and to cherish in their bosoms the love of freedom as passionately as themselves. Chapter 15. In consequence of my inability in cotton picking, Epps was in the habit of hiring me out on sugar plantations during the season of cane cutting and sugar making. He received for my services $1 a day, with the money supplying my place on his cotton plantation. Cutting cane was an employment that suited me, and for 3 successive years I held the lead row at Hawkins, leading a gang of from 50 to 100 hands. In a previous chapter, the mode of cultivating cotton is described. This may be the proper place to speak of the manner of cultivating cane. The ground is prepared in beds, the same as it is prepared for the reception of the cotton seed, except it is plowed deeper. Drills are made in the same manner. Planting commences in January and continues until April. It is necessary to plant the sugar field only once in 3 years. 3 crops are taken before the seed or plant is exhausted. 3 gangs are employed in the operation. 1 draws the cane from the rick or stack, cutting the top and flags from the stalk, leaving only that part which is sound and healthy. Each joint of the cane has an eye, like the eye of a potato, which sends forth a sprout when buried in the soil. Another gang lays the cane in the drill, placing 2 stalks side by side in such manner that joints will occur once in 4 or 6 inches. The 3rd gang follows with hoes, drawing earth upon the stalks and covering them to the depth of 3 inches. In 4 weeks, at the farthest, the sprouts appear above the ground and from this time forward grow with great rapidity. A sugar field is hoed 3 times, the same as cotton, save that a greater quantity of earth is drawn to the roots. By the 1st of August, hoeing is usually over. About the middle of September, whatever is required for seed is cut and stacked in ricks, as they are termed. In October, it is ready for the mill or sugar house, and then the general cutting begins. The blade of a cane knife is 15 inches long, 3 inches wide in the middle and tapering towards the point and handle. The blade is thin, and in order to be at all serviceable, must be kept very sharp. Every 3rd hand takes the lead of 2 others, one of whom is on each side of him. The lead hand, in the first place, with a blow of his knife, shears the flags from the stalk. He next cuts off the top down as far as it is green. He must be careful to sever all the green from the ripe part, inasmuch as the juice of the former sours the molasses and renders it unsalable. Then he severs the stalk at the root and lays it directly behind him. His right and left-hand companions lay their stalks, when cut in the same manner, upon his. To every three hands there is a cart which follows, and the stalks are thrown into it by the younger slaves when it is drawn to the sugar-house and ground. If the planter apprehends a frost, the cane is winrowed. Winrowing is cutting the stalks at an early period and throwing them lengthwise in the water furrow in such a manner that the tops will cover the butts of the stalks. They will remain in this condition 3 weeks or a month without souring and secure from frost. When the proper time arrives, they are taken up, trimmed, and carted to the sugar house. In the month of January, the slaves enter the field again to prepare for another crop. The ground is now strewn with the tops and flags cut from the past year's cane. On a dry day, fire is set to this combustible refuse, which sweeps over the field, leaving it bare and clean and ready for the hoes. The earth is loosened about the roots of the old stubble, and in process of time another crop springs up from the last year's seed. It is the same year following, but the third year the seed has exhausted its strength, and the field must be plowed and planted again. The second year the cane is sweeter and yields more than the first, and the third year more than the second. During the three seasons I labored on Hawkins' plantation, I was employed a considerable portion of the time in the sugar house. He is celebrated as the producer of the finest variety of white sugar. The following is a general description of his sugar house and the process of manufacture. The mill is an immense brick building, standing on the shore of the bayou. Running out from the building is an open shed, at least 100 feet in length and 40 or 50 feet in width. The boiler in which the steam is generated is situated outside the main building. The machinery and engine rests on a brick pier 15 feet above the floor, within the body of the building. The machinery turns 2 great iron rollers, between 2 and 3 feet in diameter and 6 or 8 feet in length. They are elevated above the brick pier and roll in towards each other. An endless carrier made of chain and wood, like leathern belts used in small mills, extends from the iron rollers out of the main building and through the entire length of the open shed. The carts in which the cane is brought from the field as fast as it is cut are unloaded at the sides of the shed. All along the endless carrier are ranged slave children, whose business it is to place the cane upon it. When it is conveyed through the shed into the main building, where it falls between the rollers, is crushed, and drops upon another carrier that conveys it out of the main building in an opposite direction, depositing it in the top of a chimney upon a fire beneath, which consumes it. It is necessary to burn it in this manner, because otherwise it would soon fill the building, and more especially because it would soon sour and engender disease. The juice of the cane falls into a conductor underneath the iron rollers and is carried into a reservoir. Pipes convey it from thence into 5 filterers, holding several hogsheads each. These filterers are filled with bone black, a substance resembling pulverized charcoal. It is made of bones calcinated in close vessels, and is used for the purpose of decolorizing by filtration the cane juice before boiling. Through these 5 filterers, it passes in succession, and then runs into a large reservoir underneath the ground floor, from whence it is carried up, by means of a steam pump, into a clarifier made of sheet iron, where it is heated by steam until it boils. From the first clarifier, it is carried in pipes to a second and a third, and thence into close iron pans, through which tubes pass, filled with steam. While in a boiling state, it flows through 3 pans in succession, and is then carried in other pipes down to the coolers on the ground floor. Coolers are wooden boxes with sieve bottoms, made of the finest wire. As soon as the syrup passes into the coolers and is met by the air, it grains, and the molasses at once escapes through the sieves in a cistern below. It is then white or loaf sugar of the finest kind, clear, clean, and as white as snow. When cool, it is taken out, packed in hogsheads, and is ready for market. The molasses is then carried from the cistern into the upper story again, and by another process converted into brown sugar. There are larger mills and those constructed differently from the one thus imperfectly described, but none perhaps more celebrated than this anywhere in Bayou Bœuf. Lambert of New Orleans is a partner of Hawkins. He is a man of vast wealth, holding, as I have been told, an interest in over 40 different sugar plantations in Louisiana. The only respite from constant labor the slave has through the whole year is during the Christmas holidays. Epps allows us 3, others allow 4, 5, and 6 days, according to the measure of their generosity. It is the only time to which they look forward with any interest or pleasure. They are glad when night comes, not only because it brings them a few hours' repose, but because it brings them one day near to Christmas. It is hailed with equal delight by the old and the young. Even Uncle Abram ceases to glorify Andrew Jackson, and Patsy forgets her many sorrows amid the general hilarity of the holidays. It is the time of feasting and frolicking and fiddling, the carnival season with the children of bondage. They are the only days when they are allowed a little restricted liberty, and heartily indeed do they enjoy it. It is the custom for one planter to give a Christmas supper, inviting the slaves from neighboring plantations to join his own on the occasion. For instance, one year it is given by Epps, the next by Marshall, the next by Hawkins, and so on. Usually from 300 to 500 are assembled, coming together on foot, in carts, on horseback, on mules, riding double and triple, sometimes a boy and a girl, at others a girl and 2 boys, and at others again a boy, a girl, and an old woman. Uncle Abram astride a mule, with Aunt Phoebe and Patsy behind him, trotting towards a Christmas supper, would be no uncommon sight on Bayou Bœuf. Then, too, of all the days of the year, they array themselves in their best attire. The cotton coat has been washed clean, the stump of a tallow candle has been applied to the shoes, and if so fortunate as to possess a rimless or a crownless hat, it is placed jauntily on the head. They are welcome with equal cordiality, however, if they come bareheaded and barefooted to the feast. As a general thing, the women wear handkerchiefs tied about their heads, but if chance has thrown in their way a fiery red ribbon or a cast-off bonnet of their mistress's grandmother, it is sure to be worn on such occasions. Red, the deep blood red, is decidedly the favorite color among the enslaved damsels of my acquaintance. If a red ribbon does not encircle the neck, you will be certain to find all the hair of their woolly heads tied up with red strings of one sort or another. The table is spread in the open air and loaded with varieties of meat and piles of vegetables. Bacon and cornmeal at such times are dispensed with. Sometimes the cooking is performed in the kitchen on the plantation, at others in the shade of wide-branching trees. In the latter case, a ditch is dug in the ground, and wood laid in and burned until it is filled with glowing coals, over which chickens, ducks, turkeys, pigs, and not unfrequently the entire body of a wild ox, are roasted. They are furnished also with flour, of which biscuits are made, and often with peach and other preserves with tarts, and every manner and description of pies, except the mince, that being an article of pastry as yet unknown among them. Only the slave who has lived all the years on his scanty allowance of meal and bacon can appreciate such suppers. White people in great numbers assemble to witness the gastronomical enjoyments. They seat themselves at the rustic table, the males on one side, the females on the other. The 2, between whom there may have been an exchange of tenderness, invariably manage to sit opposite, for the omnipresent Cupid disdains not to hurl his arrows into the simple hearts of slaves. Unalloyed and exulting happiness lights up the dark faces of them all. The ivory teeth, contrasting with their black complexions, exhibit 2 long white streaks, the whole extent of the table. All around the bountiful board, a multitude of eyes roll in ecstasy, Giggling and laughter and the clattering of cutlery and crockery succeed. Guffey's elbow clenches his neighbor's side, impelled by an involuntary impulse of delight. Nellie shakes a finger at Sambo and laughs. She knows not why. And so the fun and merriment flow on. When the viands have disappeared, and the hungry maws of the children of toil are satisfied, then, next in the order of amusement, is the Christmas dance. My business on these gala days always was to play on the violin. The African race is a music-loving one, proverbially, and many there were among my fellow bondsmen whose organs of tune were strikingly developed, and who could thumb the banjo with dexterity. But at the expense of appearing egotistical, I must nevertheless declare that I was considered the old bull of Bayou Bef. My master often received letters, sometimes from a distance of 10 miles, requesting him to send me to play at a ball or festival of the whites. He received his compensation, and usually I also returned with many picayunes jingling in my pockets, the extra contributions of those to whose delight I had administered. In this manner, I became more acquainted than I otherwise would up and down the bayou. The young men and maidens of Holmesville always knew there was to be a jollification somewhere, when if a Platt Epps was seen passing through the town with his fiddle in his hand. "Where are you going now, Platt? What is coming off tonight, Platt?" would be interrogatories issuing from every door and window, and many a time, when there was no special hurry, yielding to pressing importunities, Platt would draw his bow, and sitting astride his mule, perhaps, discourse musically to a crowd of delighted children gathered around him in the street. Alas, had it not been for my beloved violin, I scarcely could conceive how I could have endured the long years of bondage. It introduced me to great houses, relieved me of many days' labor in the field, supplied me with conveniences from a cabin, with pipes and tobacco, an extra pair of shoes, and oftentimes led me away from the presence of a hard master to witness scenes of jollity and mirth. It was my companion, the friend of my bosom, triumphing loudly when I was joyful, and uttering its soft, melodious consolations when I was sad. Often, at midnight, when sleep had fled affrighted from the cabin, and my soul was disturbed and troubled with the contemplation of my fate, it would sing me a song of peace. On holy Sabbath days, when an hour or two of leisure was allowed, it would accompany me to some quiet place on the bayou bank, and lifting up its voice, discourse kindly and pleasantly indeed. It heralded my name round the country, made me friends who otherwise would not have noticed me, gave me an honored seat at the yearly feasts, and secured the loudest and heartiest welcome of them all at the Christmas dance. The Christmas dance. Oh, ye pleasure-seeking sons and daughters of idleness, who move with measured step, listless and snail-like, through the slow winding cotillion. If you wish to look upon the celerity, if not the poetry of motion, upon genuine happiness, rampant and unrestrained, go down to Louisiana and see the slaves dancing in the starlight of a Christmas night. On that particular Christmas, I have now in my mind a description whereof will serve as a description of the day generally. Miss Lively and Mr. Sam, the first belonging to Stewart, the latter to Roberts, started the ball. It was well known that Sam cherished an ardent passion for Lively, as also did one of Marshall's and another of Carrie's boys, for Lively was lively indeed, and a heartbreaking coquette withal. It was a victory for Sam Roberts when, rising from the repast, she gave him her hand for the first figure in preference to either of his rivals. They were somewhat crestfallen, and shaking their heads angrily, rather intimated they would like to pitch into Mr. Sam and hurt him badly. But not an emotion of wrath ruffled the placid bosom of Samuel, as his legs flew like drumsticks down the outside and up the middle by the side of his bewitching partner. The whole company cheered them vociferously, and excited with the applause, they continued tearing down after all the others had become exhausted and halted a moment to recover breath. But Sam's superhuman exertions overcame him finally, leaving Lively alone, yet whirling like a top. Thereupon one of Sam's rivals, Pete Marshall, dashed in, and with might and main, leaped and shuffled and threw himself into every conceivable shape, as if determined to show Miss Lively and all the world that Sam Roberts was of no account. Pete's affection, however, was greater than his discretion. Such violent exercise took the breath out of him directly, and he dropped like an empty bag. Then was the time for Harry Carey to try his hand. But Lively also soon outwitted him, amidst hurrahs and shouts, fully sustaining her well-earned reputation of being the fastest gal on the bayou. One set off, another takes its place, he or she remaining longest on the floor, receiving the most uproarious commendation, and so the dancing continues until broad daylight. It does not cease with the sound of the fiddle, but in that case they set up a music peculiar to themselves. This is called patting, accompanied with one of those unmeaning songs, composed rather for its adaptation to a certain tune or measure than for the purpose of expressing any distinct idea. The patting is performed by striking the hands on the knees, then striking the hands together, then striking the right shoulder with one hand, the left with the other, all the while keeping time with the feet and singing, perhaps, this song. Harper's Creek and Roaring River, there, my dear, we'll live forever. Then we'll go to the Ingan Nation. All I want in this creation is pretty little wife and big plantation. Chorus. Up that oak and down that river, two overseers and one little nigger. Or if these words are not adapted to the tune called for, it may be that Old Hog Eye is a rather solemn and startling specimen of versification, not, however, to be appreciated unless heard at the South. It runneth as follows. Who's been here since I've been gone? Pretty little gal with a josie on. Hog Eye, old Hog Eye, and hosey too. Never seed the like since I was born. Here comes a little gal with a josie on. Hog Eye, old Hog Eye, and hosey too. Or may be the following, perhaps, equally nonsensical, but full of melody, nevertheless, as it flows from the negro's mouth. Ebo Dick and Jordan's Joe, them two niggers stole my yo. Chorus. Pop Jim along, walk Jim along, talk Jim along, etc. Old Black Dan, as black as tar, he damn glad he was not dar. Hop Jim along. During the remaining holidays succeeding Christmas, they are provided with passes and permitted to go where they please within a limited distance, or they may remain and labor on the plantation, in which case they are paid for it. It is very rarely, however, that the latter alternative is accepted. They may be seen at these times hurrying in all directions, as happy-looking mortals as can be found on the face of the earth. They are different beings from what they are in the field. The temporary relaxation, the brief deliverance from fear and from the lash, producing an entire metamorphosis in their appearance and demeanor. In visiting, riding, renewing old friendships, or perchance, reviving some old attachment, or pursuing whatever pleasure may suggest itself, the time is occupied. Such is Southern life as it is. 3 days in the year, as I found it, the other 362 being days of weariness and fear and suffering and unremitting labor. Marriage is frequently contracted during the holidays, if such an institution may be said to exist among them. The only ceremony required before entering into that holy estate is to obtain the consent of the respective owners. It is usually encouraged by the masters of female slaves. Either party can have as many husbands or wives as the owner will permit, and either is at liberty to discard the other at pleasure. The law in relation to divorce or to bigamy and so forth is not applicable to property, of course. If the wife does not belong on the same plantation with the husband, the latter is permitted to visit her on Saturday nights, if the distance is not too far. Uncle Abram's wife lived 7 miles from Epps on Bayou Huff Power. He had permission to visit her once a fortnight, but he was growing old, as has been said, and truth to say, had latterly well-nigh forgotten her. Uncle Abram had no time to spare from his meditations on General Jackson, connubial dalliance being well enough for the young and thoughtless, but unbecoming a grave and solemn philosopher like himself. Chapter 16. With the exception of my trip to St. Mary's Parish and my absence during the cane-cutting seasons, I was constantly employed on the plantation of Master Epps. He was considered but a small planter, not having a sufficient number of hands to require the services of an overseer, acting in the latter capacity himself. Not able to increase his force, it was his custom to hire during the hurry of cotton picking. On larger estates, employing 50 or 100 or perhaps 200 hands, an overseer is deemed indispensable. These gentlemen ride into the field on horseback, without an exception, to my knowledge, armed with pistols, bowie knife, whip, and accompanied by several dogs. They follow, equipped in this fashion, in rear of the slaves, keeping a sharp lookout upon them all. The requisite qualifications in an overseer are utter heartlessness, brutality, and cruelty. It is his business to produce large crops, and if that is accomplished, no matter what amount of suffering it may have cost. The presence of the dogs are necessary to overhaul a fugitive who may take to his heels, as is sometimes the case. When faint or sick, he is unable to maintain his row and unable also to endure the whip. The pistols are reserved for any dangerous emergency, there having been instances when such weapons were necessary. Goaded into uncontrollable madness, even the slave will sometimes turn upon his oppressor. The gallows were standing at Marksville last January, upon which one was executed a year ago for killing his overseer. It occurred not many miles from Epps' plantation on Red River. The slave was given his task at splitting rails. In the course of the day, the overseer sent him on an errand, which occupied so much time that it was not possible for him to perform the task. The next day he was called to an account, but the loss of time occasioned by the errand was no excuse, and he was ordered to kneel and bare his back for the reception of the lash. They were in the woods alone, beyond the reach of sight or hearing. The boy, submitted until maddened at such injustice and insane with pain, he sprang to his feet and, seizing an axe, literally chopped the overseer in pieces. He made no attempt whatever at concealment, but hastening to his master, related the whole affair, and declared him ready to expiate the wrong by the sacrifice of his life. He was led to the scaffold, and while the rope was around his neck, maintained an undismayed and fearless bearing, and with his last words justified the act. Besides the overseer, there are drivers under him, the number being in proportion to the number of hands in the field. The drivers are black, and who, in addition to the performance of their equal share of work, are compelled to do the whipping of their several gangs. Whips hang around their necks, and if they fail to use them thoroughly, are whipped themselves. They have a few privileges, however. For example, in cane cutting, the hands are not allowed to sit down long enough to eat their dinners. Carts filled with corn cake, cooked at the kitchen, are driven into the fields at noon. The cake is distributed by the drivers and must be eaten with the least possible delay. When the slave ceases to perspire, as he often does when taxed beyond his strength, he falls to the ground and becomes entirely helpless. It is then the duty of the driver to drag him into the shade of the standing cotton or cane or a neighboring tree, where he dashes buckets of water upon him, and uses other means of bringing out perspiration again, when he is ordered to his place and compelled to continue his labor. At Huff Power, when I first came to Epps, Tom, one of Robert's negroes, was driver. He was a burly fellow and severe in the extreme. After Epps' removal to Bayou Bœuf, that distinguished honor was conferred upon myself. Up to the time of my departure, I had to wear a whip about my neck in the field. If Epps was present, I dared not show any lenity, not having the Christian fortitude of a certain well-known Uncle Tom sufficiently to brave his wrath by refusing to perform the office. In that way only I escaped the immediate martyrdom he suffered, and withal saved my companions much suffering, as it proved in the end. Epps, I soon found, whether actually in the field or not, had his eyes pretty generally upon us. From the piazza, from behind some adjacent tree, or other concealed point of observation, he was perpetually on the watch. If one of us had been backward or idle through the day, we were apt to be told all about it on returning to the quarters, and as it was a matter of principle with him to reprove every offense of that kind that came within his knowledge, the offender not only was certain of receiving a castigation for his tardiness, but I likewise was punished for permitting it. If, on the other hand, he had seen me use the lash freely, the man was satisfied. Practice makes perfect, truly, and during my 8 years' experience as a driver, I learned to handle my whip with marvelous dexterity and precision, throwing the lash within a hair's breadth of the back, the ear, the nose, without, however, touching either of them. If Epps was observed at a distance, or we had reason to apprehend he was sneaking somewhere in the vicinity, I would commence plying the lash vigorously, when, according to arrangement, they would squirm and screech as if in agony, although not one of them had, in fact, even been grazed. Patsy would take occasion, if he made his appearance presently, to mumble his hearing some complaints that Platt was lashing them the whole time. And Uncle Abram, with an appearance of honesty peculiar to himself, would declare roundly, "I had just whipped them worse than General Jackson whipped the enemy at New Orleans." If Epps was not drunk and in one of his beastly humors, this was, in general, satisfactory. If he was, someone or more of us must suffer, as a matter of course. Sometimes his violence assumed a dangerous form, placing the lives of his human stock in jeopardy. On one occasion, the drunken madman thought to amuse himself by cutting my throat. He had been absent in Holmesville, in attendance at a shooting match, and none of us were aware of his return. While hoeing by the side of Patsy, she exclaimed in a low voice suddenly, "Platt, do you see old Hog Jaw beckoning me to come to him?" Glancing sideways, I discovered him in the edge of the field, motioning and grimacing, as was his habit when half-intoxicated. Aware of his lewd intentions, Patsy began to cry. I whispered her not to look up and to continue at her work, as if she had not observed him. Suspecting the truth of the matter, however, he soon staggered up to me in a great rage. "What did you say to Pats?" he demanded with an oath. I made him some evasive answer, which only had the effect of increasing his violence. "How long have you owned this plantation? Say, you damn nigger," he inquired, with a malicious sneer, at the same time taking hold of my shirt collar with one hand and thrusting the other into his pocket. "Now I'll cut your black throat, that's what I'll do," drawing his knife from his pocket as he said it. But with one hand he was unable to open it, until finally seizing the blade in his teeth, I saw he was about to succeed and felt the necessity of escaping from him. For in this present reckless state, it was evident he was not joking by any means. My shirt was open in front, and as I turned round quickly and sprang from him, while he still retained his grip, it was stripped entirely from my back. There was no difficulty now in eluding him. He would chase me until out of breath, then stop until it was recovered, swear, and renew the chase again. Now he would command me to come to him, now endeavor to coax me, but I was careful to keep at a respectful distance. In this manner we made the circuit of the field several times, he making desperate plunges, and I always dodging them, more amused than frightened, well knowing that when his sober senses returned he would laugh at his own drunken folly. At length I observed the mistress standing by the yard fence, watching our half-serious, half-comical maneuvers. Shooting past him, I ran directly to her. Epps, on discovering her, did not follow. He remained about the field an hour or more, during which time I stood by the mistress, having related the particulars of what had taken place. Now she was aroused again, denouncing her husband and Patsy about it equally. Finally, Epps came towards the house, by this time nearly sober, walking demurely, with his hands behind his back, and attempting to look as innocent as a child. As he approached, nevertheless, Mistress Epps began to berate him roundly, heaping upon him many rather disrespectful epithets, and demanding for what reason he had attempted to cut my throat. Epps made wondrous strange of it all, and to my surprise, swore by all the saints in the calendar he had not spoken to me that day. "Platt, you lying nigger, have I?" was his brazen appeal to me. It is not safe to contradict the master, even by the assertion of a truth. So I was silent, and when he entered the house I returned to the field, and the affair was never after alluded to. Shortly after this time, a circumstance occurred that came nigh divulging the secret of my real name and history, which I had so long and carefully concealed, upon which I was convinced depended my final escape. Soon after he purchased me, Epps asked if I could write and read, and on being informed that I had received some instruction in those branches of education, he assured me, with emphasis, if he ever caught me with a book or with pen and ink, he would give me 100 lashes. He said he wanted me to understand that he brought niggers to work and not to educate. He never inquired a word of my past life or from whence I came. The mistress, however, cross-examined me frequently about Washington, which she supposed was my native city, and more than once remarked that I did not talk nor act like the other niggers, and she was sure I had seen more of the world than I admitted. My great object always was to invent means of getting a letter secretly into the post office, directed to some of my friends or family at the North. The difficulty of such an achievement cannot be comprehended by one unacquainted with the severe restrictions imposed upon me. In the first place, I was deprived of pen, ink, and paper. In the second place, a slave cannot leave his plantation without a pass, nor will a postmaster mail a letter for one without written instructions from his owner. I was in slavery 9 years, and always watchful and on the alert, before I met with the good fortune of obtaining a sheet of paper. While Epps was in New Orleans one winter, disposing of his cotton, the mistress sent me to Holmesville with an order for several articles, and among the rest a quantity of foolscap. I appropriated a sheet, concealing it in the cabin under the board on which I slept. After various experiments, I succeeded in making ink by boiling white maple bark, and with a feather plucked from the wing of a duck, manufactured a pen. When all were asleep in the cabin by the light of the coals, lying upon my plank couch, I managed to complete a somewhat lengthy epistle. It was directed to an old acquaintance at Sandy Hill, stating my condition and urging him to take measures to restore me to liberty. This letter I kept a long time, contriving measures by which it could safely be deposited in the post office. At length, a low fellow by the name of Ormsby, hitherto a stranger, came into the neighborhood, seeking a situation as overseer. He applied to Epps and was about the plantation for several days. He next went over to Shaw's, nearby, and remained with him several weeks. Shaw was generally surrounded by such worthless characters, being himself noted as a gambler and unprincipled man. He had made a wife of a slave, Charlotte, and a brood of young mulattoes were growing up in his house. Ormsby became so much reduced at last that he was compelled to labor with the slaves. A white man working in the field is a rare and unusual spectacle on Bayou Bœuf. I improved every opportunity of cultivating his acquaintance privately, desiring to obtain his confidence so far as to be willing to entrust the letter to his keeping. He visited Marksville repeatedly, he informed me, a town some 20 miles distant, and there I proposed to myself the letter should be mailed. Carefully deliberating on the most proper manner of approaching him on the subject, I concluded finally to ask him simply if he would deposit a letter for me in the Marksville post office the next time he visited that place, without disclosing to him that the letter was written or any of the particulars it contained, for I had fears that he might betray me, and knew that some inducement must be held out to him of a pecuniary nature, before it would be safe to confide in him. As late as 1 o'clock one night, I stole noiselessly from my cabin, and crossing the field to Shaw's, found him sleeping on the piazza. I had but a few picayunes, the proceeds of my fiddling performances, but all I had in the world I promised him if he would do me the favor required. I begged him not to expose me if he could not grant the request. He assured me, upon his honor, he would deposit it in the Marksville post office, and that he would keep it an inviolable secret forever. Though the letter was in my pocket at the time, I dared not then deliver it to him, but stating I would have it written in a day or two, bade him good night, and returned to my cabin. It was impossible for me to expel the suspicions I entertained, and all night I lay awake, revolving in my mind the safest course to pursue. I was willing to risk a great deal to accomplish my purpose, but should the letter, by any means, fall into the hands of Epps, it would be a death blow to my aspirations. I was perplexed in the extreme. My suspicions were well-founded, as the sequel demonstrated. The next day but one, while scraping cotton in the field, Epps seated himself on the line fence between Shaw's plantation and his own, in such a position as to overlook the scene of our labors. Presently, Ormsby made his appearance, and mounting the fence, took a seat beside him. There remained 2 or 3 hours, all of which time I was in an agony of apprehension. That night, while broiling my bacon, Epps entered the cabin with his rawhide in his hand.
"Well, boy," said he, "I understand I got a larned nigger that writes letters and tries to get white fellows to mail 'em. Wonder if you know who he is?"
My worst fears were realized, and although it may not be considered entirely creditable, even under the circumstances, yet a resort to duplicity and downright falsehood was the only refuge that presented itself. "Don't know nothing about it, Master Epps," I answered him, assuming an air of ignorance and surprise. "Don't know nothing at all about it, sir." "Won't you over to Shaw's night before last?" he inquired. "No, master," was the reply. "Haven't you asked that fellow Ormsby to mail a letter for you at Marksville?" "Why, Lord, master, I never spoke 3 words to him in all my life. I don't know what you mean." "Well," he continued, "Ormsby told me today the devil was among my niggers, that I had one that needed close watching, or he would run away. And when I asked him why, he said you come over to Shaw's and waked him up in the night and wanted him to carry a letter to Marksville. What have you got to say to that, huh?"
"All I've got to say, master," I replied, "is there is no truth in it. How could I write a letter without any ink or paper? There is nobody I want to write to, because I ain't got no friends living as I know of. That Ormsby is a lying, drunken fellow, they say, and nobody believes him, anyway. You know, I always tell the truth, and that I never go off the plantation without a pass. Now, master, I can see what that Ormsby is after, plain enough. Didn't he want you to hire him for an overseer?"
"Yes, he wanted me to hire him," answered Epps.
"That's it," said I. "He wants to make you believe we're all going to run away, and then he thinks you'll hire an overseer to watch us. He just made that story out of whole cloth, because he wants to get a situation. It's all a lie, master. You may depend on it."
Epps mused a while, evidently impressed with the plausibility of my theory, and exclaimed, "I'm damned, Platt, if I don't believe you tell the truth. He must take me for a soft, to think he can come it over me with them kind of yarns, mustn't he? Maybe he thinks he can fool me. Maybe he thinks I don't know nothing. Can't take care of my own niggers, eh? Soft soap old Epps, eh? Ha, ha, ha!"
"Damn Ormsby! Set the dogs on him, Platt." And with many other comments descriptive of Ormsby's general character, and his capability of taking care of his own business and attending to his own niggers, Master Epps left the cabin. As soon as he was gone, I threw the letter in the fire, and with a desponding and despairing heart, beheld the epistle which had cost me so much anxiety and thought, and which I fondly hoped would have been my forerunner to the land of freedom, writhe and shrivel on its bed of coals, and dissolve into smoke and ashes. Ormsby, the treacherous wretch, was driven from Shaw's plantation not long subsequently, much to my relief, for I feared he might renew his conversation and perhaps induce Epps to credit him. I knew not now whither to look for deliverance. Hope sprang up in my heart only to be crushed and blighted. The summer of my life was passing away. I felt I was growing prematurely old, that a few years more and toil and grief and the poisonous miasmas of the swamps would accomplish their work upon me, would consign me to the grave's embrace, to moulder and be forgotten. Repelled, betrayed, cut off from the hope of succor, I could only prostrate myself upon the earth and groan in unutterable anguish. The hope of rescue was the only light that cast a ray of comfort on my heart. That was now flickering, faint and low. Another breath of disappointment would extinguish it altogether, leaving me to grope in midnight darkness to the end of life. Chapter 17. The year, 1850, down to which time I have now arrived, omitting many occurrences uninteresting to the reader, was an unlucky year for my companion Wiley, the husband of Phoebe, whose taciturn and retiring nature has thus far kept him in the background. Notwithstanding, Wiley seldom opened his mouth and revolved in his obscure and unpretending orbit without a grumble. Nevertheless, the warm elements of sociality were strong in the bosom of that silent nigger. In the exuberance of his self-reliance, disregarding the philosophy of Uncle Abram, and setting the counsels of Aunt Phoebe utterly at naught, he had the foolhardiness to essay a nocturnal visit to a neighboring cabin without a pass. So attractive was the society in which he found himself,